Mr. Hitchens has a knack for making anyone he converses with sound stupid. A powerful command of language and debate, he uses his repertoire to endorse social conservatism and attack Blairite doctrine. On Brexit, his position might surprise you, though. Far from rabid Brexiteering, and he hates the word Brexit, he advocates magnanimity in victory and for consensus to take the UK toward membership of the European Economic Area. Hitchens calls for an off-the-shelf Norway model, plug-in and go, flat-pack Brexit light. He also described the country as in a pre-Civil War condition. I'm Ollie Dugmore, and you're about to listen to Peter Hitchens make me sound stupid.
Hello.
Hi, Peter. It's Ollie. How are you?
So far, so good. Okay, here we are. Let's go.
Brilliant. Let's just get straight into it then. Peter Hitchens, the country is divided more so than it was on June 24th, 2016. You're either a racist or you're a snowflake. What's the solution?
Solution is obviously compromise. I never wanted a referendum. I didn't vote in it. I thought it was a severe mistake and a danger to the Constitution. I still do. I have the feeling at the moment that if we're not careful, we're moving into a pre-Civil War position because so many people are no longer prepared even to speak to each other. I think there has to be a recognition here. The country is very evenly divided and that a decision of this kind is very hard to take on the basis of a very small majority. And I think those who are on the winning side ought to recognise that had it gone the other way in the same numbers, they would have felt pretty uncomfortable about it too. I just say these things as someone who loves this country and its people and doesn't want to see them at each other's throats. There does seem to me to be an obvious compromise available, which both I and my friend Christopher Booker have been suggesting for some time, but I don't think people are ready to actually accept it or examine it yet. But I think that moment will come as they realise just how difficult the position is that we're now in.
And what is that compromise?
The compromise is the Norway option, where we stay, certainly for the foreseeable future, in the European Economic Area, which takes us out of the customs union, but leaves us in the single market, and allows us a considerable measure through the Liechtenstein compromise of control over our own borders, far more than we have now. My own view is not only would this work straight off the shelf without any great negotiation, you could take it off the shelf, plug it in, and it would start functioning, but also that it contains many of the demands which the people who voted to leave wanted to get without trampling on the desires of those who wanted to stay, and it would be workable. The other point I would make about this is that although I have for many years believed this country should be independent and wanted it to leave the European Union and would have chosen another route to do so, the fact is that we've been dependent and a province for so long that many of the muscles necessary for full independence have atrophied and shriveled away. And we're not in a very strong position suddenly to say, right, we're an independent nation. We may need a compromise in any case, and I think people should consider that as well. I'm also very worried about the state of the British economy as it stands and its ability to withstand any period of uncertainty, whichever side of the euro fence we happen to be on.
Yeah, we'll come to the economy in due
course.
Yeah,
okay, well, let's do that.
But on Liechtenstein, what you're referring to there, I believe, is the emergency brake, in quotation marks.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could put it like that, but it happens to have been a concession made, which is a concession in principle, which is a precedent which this country could exploit. Everybody says, well, Liechtenstein's very small. I say, well, so what? If you can concede that any country can actually ask for a break on immigration within that system, then you can concede that another country can, and I really don't see any problem with that. I do think that we must understand there must be people in the EU countries who also want a compromise, who don't want a violent and let's not say violent, but jagged and an ill-tempered breach, but would rather reach an intelligent and an amicable solution to the problem of Britain leaving the European Union, which I think it must do to some extent. But though I've always said from the very beginning of this that we will move from being half in the European Union to half out of it, total independence of the European Union doesn't seem to me to be available to a country with such a weak economy and with such atrophied and shriveled political institutions and indeed military power.
The divide we mentioned at the beginning of this interview, I think it's fair to say it's quite generational. What solace do you think young people can take from our departure in March 2019?
Well, I think people should stop worrying so much. I spent an awful lot of time in the weeks after the referendum reassuring a Polish acquaintance who works in the Starbucks I use a lot, that his position would be okay, because it will be, and that he wasn't going to be suddenly flung out of the country. A lot of people have fantasies about the effect of leaving the European Union, most of which are totally untrue, and some of which are at best half true, and they should get over them. It won't actually make all that much difference to many things once we leave. It's perfectly possible, for instance, to be in the Erasmus scheme without being in the EU, and all kinds of other things are possible as well. I can understand why people brought up since the end of British patriotism feel a kind of attachment to Europe. But they should understand that the people of my generation who were brought up as British patriots also feel an attachment to the continent of Europe. I spent a huge amount of my time traveling with pleasure in all parts of the continent. I've lived in a European country, though not in an EU one. The idea that these things would only have been possible inside the EU is false. It's never been that difficult. And the relations won't suddenly plunge. We won't suddenly have an iron curtain between us and the continent. I think people should get over it a bit and stop being quite so hysterical sometimes.
It did take Theresa May.
Just examine the facts of the position. And see what will happen. It's still going to be a lot harder to get into the United States than it's going to be getting to France.
Absolutely. But it did take Theresa May, a while to guarantee the rights of those 3.2 million EU citizens living in the UK.
Well, I don't, and that was a perfectly reasonable, I said at the time, a perfectly reasonable negotiating position, because she had to worry about the position of British citizens or subjects, as I prefer to call them, living on the continent.
Yeah.
And it would have been crazy to give away a major negotiating peace until you'd actually got something in return for it. So no one ever imagined that there was an intention to expel all these people. In any case, under British immigration law, many of them have long ago obtained a right to remain. If they've worked here for long enough, they have an absolute right under law to remain, whatever the government does. So it was an exaggerated problem and an emotionalized problem, as so many of these things are on both sides. I have to say, I'm not neutral in the matter, and they say I would prefer this country to be independent because I think independence is of itself a good thing.
Yeah.
But I don't. I do think that many on what you could call my side, as well as many on the other side, simply overstate things far too much.
To go to a sort of, well, the only real piece of news that's sort of wrapping itself around Westminster at the moment, I think it's fair to say the government is creaking, and one of those fronts that it's creaking on is Northern Ireland, where an inability to resolve the power-sharing crisis could threaten the Tory-DUP coalition. The other, though, is Westminster. And if Michael Fallon's resignation sets a precedent, we can probably expect other veterans from the 1997 intake to go. Crucially, the Prime Minister's few allies are largely from that 1997 intake. So how does this scandal affect the process of leaving the EU? What impact could it have?
I have no idea what may emerge about people, and in the current atmosphere of swollen, purple-faced rage, I'm really not sure what would be taken seriously and what would be regarded as an unforgivable crime and what wouldn't be, to be completely honest with you. I have no knowledge of the groping habits of the 1997 intake of the Conservative Party. Being a bloke, I haven't been groped. And I don't work down there anymore, so I haven't witnessed much in the way of groping. I simply don't know. But what I do think is that this government being so weak and frail in the first place, it wouldn't take much of a landslide of emotionalism to destroy it altogether. There's not much. It's not held together by very strong cement at the moment, and it wouldn't take all that much of a push to make the whole thing fall down, and I can't see where this might end. It is worrying, but the whole position since the general election has been very worrying. It's been clear that the government is under the leadership of people who don't actually have the faintest idea what they're doing.
So perhaps
one of the problems about this is that you've had again the referendum, the constitutional ridiculousness of a government composed almost entirely of people who want to stay in the European Union, are diligently attempting to fulfil a mandate from a referendum telling them to do the opposite of their own desires. And of course, people forced to do the opposite of what they want to do, are often more zealous in doing it than they would be if they wanted to do it, because they're trying to prove that they're capable of doing what they've been ordered to do. And I think there's a lot of that in the current government, the whole Article 50 business and the rush towards exit was, I think, very much driven by the fear of being denounced as secret Europhiles, which of course they all are anyway.
What do you reckon the solution to that constitutional crisis is then?
Well, the solution would have been not to have held a referendum. But I'm afraid damage once done is often irreparable. And I think the damage that this has done to our parliamentary system is probably irreparable. And I don't see any way that it can ever be undone, which is one of the things which worries me. I have for some years thought this country was in a state of irreversible decline anyway. So I think that this is just another part of that, I'm afraid.
Mm. Okay. An opposition motion has coerced the government into publishing its Brexit impact studies. Is that particularly significant, considering the EU already publishes their own and the Bank of England is also fairly vocal about things like job losses and interest rates?
Not to me. My brain glazes over at most of this stuff. I'm just not really very interested. I've no doubt you could make... What does an impact study mean? It's ultimately, it's subjective. We'll find out what the impact is when it actually happens.
Yeah.
And whoever wrote it will decide what it says. You'll have to forgive me, but my interest in this whole thing, it's not huge. I'm fascinated by the issue of national independence and long thought that it would be a good idea, and was, I have to say, completely astonished when the referendum took place to find people who I had known for many years to be either utterly complacent about or uninterested in the subject or against leaving the European Union, suddenly joining the side of leaving. And I just can't really understand what happened and why these people all rallied around a cause which I was in it before they came. Was a pretty select group of people. I don't really understand it. One day I will. It's just I still haven't fully understood what happened in Moscow in 1991, and I was there. And I'm in the same position about this. What actually is going on? Why are all these people suddenly not doing what you would naturally have expected them to do?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that brain drain is fairly mutual across any of the people I interview about the subject.
I'm sure it is. I think the trouble is that it is very, very. It was always very hard in discussing the issue of national sovereignty to actually make it concrete in people's minds, and it still is. And the other thing is, most people don't have any kind of clue about economics, and they do find the difficulties of the European single market and the customs union and the fact that they're not the same thing, for instance, very difficult. You mentioned the Irish problem though earlier on, and that is a really difficult position because it being a land border, it is the one place at which the new arrangements will immediately enforce themselves quite severely and in a way that they won't do anywhere else in the country. And you can see that no one really has a clue what will actually happen when we become, in trading terms, a third country and can no longer benefit from the procedures of the single market. I mean, Christopher Booker has written a lot of very interesting stuff about this. He is of the belief that it will basically mean that the borders will have to close. I know people who are of a different cast of mind to him who know about customs, who say that actually customs checks are not as physical as they used to be, and this won't necessarily happen. But I have to say, I think it seems persuasive to me that there will be a pretty deep change, and it will be very hard to manage if they can't come up with a solution before the day of departure. And as I say, the obvious way of solving it before the day of departure is to go for Norway and get into the European Economic Area.
Yeah, we had Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor, on previously, and he was talking about one of the workable models you could perhaps have on the motorways, where lorries, you know, are going across the border regularly, is perhaps to install cameras that check license plates and, you know, see if that corresponds then to a database.
I think there are the way in which customs have done this is much under the World Customs Organization, which is a separate thing from the WTO. A lot of the obvious problems of taking things across borders have been got rid of electronically and by advance clearance. But even so, it seems to me, particularly where you've got industries where materials move backwards and forwards between the two jurisdictions, it's going to be very difficult to achieve a working arrangement.
Absolutely. Another perhaps gobby institution will say about this process is the university, something I know you've been vocal on in the past. Is it appropriate for vice chancellors to be taking a position, and how should politics lecturers be teaching the process of our departure?
Oh, I don't mind at all people taking public positions as long as they do it clearly. I mean, I wish, for instance, that the BBC would openly come out and declare that it was on the side of remaining instead of pretending to be impartial. I've read, let a thousand flowers bloom, as long as people are honest about where they stand. I thought the whole fuss about the universities was very funny. And Robert Toombs, a great man, who's one of the few leavers at the University of Cambridge, as I understand, it said at the time when this minister sent out and asked for details of what people had been saying in lectures or whatever, any colleague of mine would be absolutely delighted to find himself on a government list of people they didn't like. It would be a huge career boost. And I thought that was the correct attitude to take towards it. No, let people disagree. Let them say what they like. But all I ask is that nobody tries to pretend that they're impartial when they're not, and that nobody pretends that an opinion is a fact. That's all I ever ask in public debate. So many people can't do this. They will insist on, particularly as the BBC being the worst culprit, on pretending that they don't have a position when they do have one. And other people will insist on imagining that their opinion is a fact and that therefore no one can disagree with it. But apart from that, no, I think I'm always very happy, to be honest. But they have to do the same favor in return. If, for instance, a teacher in a university has a student who he's supervising in some way who has an opposite view, if I were to hear that such a student had lost marks or had been downgraded as a result of holding an opposite view, then I would go after that teacher with all the furies at my command, because that would be a disgraceful thing to do.
Absolutely.
And if there's any of that going on, I couldn't condemn it enough. But in terms of just people saying what they think, for goodness sake, we are more or less, within some limits, still a free country. And the last thing I would want to do would be to discourage people from saying what they meant.
Everyone's entitled to an opinion.
And not just that, they're entitled to have their opinion heard, and they're entitled to have their opinion intelligently and reasonably answered and rebutted, rather than ignored or talked over.
All right, then. To economics. In the past, you've called the city one of the only functioning parts of our economy. Can it function outside of the single market?
I think so, but I think you'd only find out once we got out. And it's not a question of whether it can function so much as whether it'll function as well as it does now.
Yeah.
And it does get terribly technical, and I don't claim to understand it. But there's an awful lot of money riding on it, and an awful lot of very expert people. I'd be amazed if it couldn't function, or indeed if it couldn't overcome many of the difficulties that arose, because it's always been good at that. But whether it would function better or as well, I simply am not in a position to say. I don't know enough.
Yeah, it's a risky strategy to adopt, though, isn't it? Just to go for it and then see if it works.
Well, yes, of course it is. My favoured route out was for a political party to stand in a general election committed to leaving the European Union, but also at the same time knowing why it wanted to do so and having a coherent programme for doing so, and also being in no mad rush to do so, because if it had been elected on that programme and it was setting out to do it, it wouldn't have needed to prove itself in the way that the current government feels the need to.
Mm.
You see what I mean? It's this frantic need among the Tory parties, higher echelons, most of whom long to stay in the European Union, to prove that they're doing the bidding of the referendum, that makes them so zealous.
Yeah. Do you think that's fair to say the majority of the higher echelons of the Conservative Party long to stay in the European Union? Euroscepticism has always been...
I mean, until very recently, anybody in the parliamentary Tory party who joined an organisation called Better Off Out, which openly declared that it believed that we were better off outside the European Union, any MP who joined that was spoken to sharply by the whips and warned that he wouldn't get any preferment. And certainly nobody would get ministerial office. And most people were prepared to accept that. And it was very rare to find a Tory MP of any standing who was actually openly in favour of secession. There were these people called Eurosceptics, but that just meant they were rude about the European Union in opposition and quite happy to get on with it in government. They don't count. But actual people who wanted to leave and wanted to be independent and understood that there might be a price to pay for that and were prepared to pay it, I think very small numbers of Conservative MPs fall in that group. And if they did think that, then they were very, very good at hiding it for a number of years.
What about Liam Fox and David Davis?
What about them?
Well, they're both fairly staunch, I think it's fair to say, leavers. They're both at one time or another been in the upper ranks of the Conservative Party.
Where were they before the referendum?
True, good point. I mean, they've both thrown their hat into the ring for the leadership, but I suppose they've never really been a significant part of French
politics. I don't recall, even in times when he was in the outer darkness, David Davis, whom I quite like, I have to say, ever joining open campaigns for a seat in the European Union, or doing what, in my view, anybody who had that view ought to have done in the Conservative Party of the Cameron era, which is to leave it.
Perhaps for the reasons you've already stated.
Well, sure, I don't know. Politics is like that. But all I'm saying is that the Conservative Party is not by any means a party committed to leaving the EU. On the contrary, it is the party of the EU. It is the party that first of all, under Macmillan, sought to get us in, and then under Heath, got us into the EU, and indeed in the 1975 referendum campaign to keep us in, with a certain Mrs. Margaret Thatcher prominent in that campaign.
Mm.
It's amazing the changes people undergo.
Yeah. Okay, finally, Nigel Farage was successful in linking border control and migration with the European Union.
Yes.
Assuming the UK continues to supplement its economy with the necessary immigration that it needs, how can we expect anti-immigrant sentiment to be played out without a scapegoat in Brussels?
Do you mean anti-immigration sentiment, surely?
Yes, sorry, yes.
I mean, I do hate that that little slip of word. I don't think that people who oppose immigration anti-immigrant, and I think that it's a grave offence against language and truth to treat them as if they were.
I'll put my hand up to that one.
Well, I think it should. You know, please stop doing it. The BBC does it all the time, and I tire of it. I don't know. I think one of the problems with mass migration is that it has, to some extent, happened, and there are now very large numbers of people in this country who've come from abroad and here they are in our multicultural society, which doesn't try very hard to integrate them, but in very large numbers, where the society tends to adapt to their presence rather than ask them to adapt to the host country. And I think we have that problem. We're going to have to make the best of it. I'm not sure that there is now any solution to it. And I think it's very likely that many of them are going to leave. And it would be completely improper to try and try and push them into leaving. So I think my own view is that whatever you may have thought about it in the past, we have to learn to live with the new population that we have in the most civilized way we possibly can. I'm not sure that anything can now be done. I mean, having argued very much against this migration when it was taking place and been called all kinds of rude names for doing so, I now have to say, well, my basic impulse was in favour of doing something which I thought would keep the country more civilised than it would otherwise be. But now I have to say, civilisation is what I'm in favour of, and that must involve integration. I just wish we'd stop being multicultural and become more integrationist. I think that would be a long, long step towards solving the problem.
A good answer, I think. Okay, brilliant, Peter. That's the end of my questions. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Brilliant, Peter. Thank you for your time. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Peter Hitchens is an author and columnist for The Mail on Sunday. Both he and myself are on Twitter. I'm at Ollie Dugmore, OLIDUGMORE. Or for Peter, at Clark Micah. And as always, at Brexit Podcast. The Brexit Podcast has been brought to you by Tim Hemming, Jennifer Hahn, Warren Pohl and Ollie Dugmore, with the theme music by the one and only Kevin MacLeod.